Let me tell you about something new. A new show called G's Power.
G's Power.
Real talk for real saints.
Are you ready?
And it's for real.
Welcome to G's Power Hour, live every weekday at 11:30 a.m. on Never Had It So Good Entertainment Network. Your host, G, will bring you informative and entertaining guests and a variety of topics in a way that you can absorb and enjoy. Listen in weekdays and call in at 516-387-1944. We love interaction. All shows can be downloaded if you miss one or found on iTunes the next day. G's Power Hour is powered by Never Had It So Good Sports Media Network.
G's Power Hour.
Yeah.
Well, good morning, brothers and sisters, kings and queens, angels and saints. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. And we are exploring an area that doesn't get talked about too much, and you just don't know what's really going on when you just look at things at face value. A friend of mine, a longtime friend of mine, I'm privileged to say, has written a book about what goes on behind the scenes of television news, especially with our ladies leading the decisions and operations. And her name is Dr. Ava Thompson-Greenwell. Good morning, Dr. Greenwell. How are you? Oh dear. Is she not there? Wow. We're going to get to her shortly then, I guess. So anyway, if you have something that you want to discuss, the number, before we get to Ava, the number is 516-387-1944. We've been planning this for a while. I'm hoping that, you know, she's all right. So hoping she'll be on soon. Anyway, if you want to talk about anything, I guess I would like to get some feedback from folks in terms of a couple of things, situation going on in Haiti. I did post a couple of things yesterday regarding that. This tears my heart, and I have friends that have friends and relatives there in Haiti, and you know, and a good portion of my church membership is from Haiti and has family and friends down there. So we need to keep them in prayer. And just between the political turmoil and just the horrible, horrific things that have happened between the variety of natural disasters, the storms and the earthquakes, it's just awful, and we pray for them. And that, and one of the things that I saw that I was glad to see, there's a gentleman that's flying down there that was taking, I know he wasn't taking quite a few things, but I'm going to try to find out exactly if there are any other needs that he has. But he was taking some desalination equipment down there, you know, because right now, you know, that with the water supply probably being tainted and everything, there's needs for purification and desalination of the water down there. And he was flying down there with, I think it was 10 of these desalination machines. And I would personally, I've always been a fan of being able to use desalination as a means to get water for various uses. And I would like kind of find out exactly how much these portable machines cost, and if there's any way to assist them with that effort, because I know with 10 machines and everything that's going down there, that's not going to be nearly enough. And, you know, having to power those machines, I'm looking into, I know we're going to have Burton Kelso on Thursday, and I'm looking into, I've asked him if he could possibly look into any type of solar tech that could be used to assist down there. Anyway, let me know what your thoughts are. And if you have family and friends in the area in Haiti, give us a call at 516-387-1944 and let us know if what your, you know, any information that you've been getting that we can share, just to make sure that, you know, we can do whatever it is possible to help down there. My other concern is also about the women in Afghanistan, in terms of, you know, what's been going on with them, how will their lives change, and will they still be able to thrive and go forward? News reports keep saying that they're offering, I guess you could say, amnesty of a sort, and want to include women in some of the processes, but there's still a lot of hesitation given the past history. So we're going to look at that too. But anyway, we're going to take a quick break. I'm going to try to track down Ava. And, you know, like I said, if you have any other things you want to discuss today, the number is 516-387-1944. Wait a minute. I'm hearing some background noise. Ava, are you there?
I am here, yes.
Yay. Good morning. Welcome. How
good
are
morning.
You?
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Thank you.
Always a great time to hear your voice. You know, like Ava and I were hanging buddies back in the good old days in a way, you know, tried to just, you know, break down some barriers in television news and journalism in general when we were in the Tampa area, and she's gone on to do some awesome things. And like I said, the book that we're going to talk about is Ladies Leading. Tell me, what got you started with this?
So back in, 2009, I started a PhD program in African American Studies, and I knew that I needed to get this thing done during the time period that I had, and so I had to go in already with an idea of what I wanted my dissertation to be. And so I had always been interested, even during our time working in Tampa, thinking about women like yourself, right, who are working behind the scenes, who are writing, but also women who are managers, who are leading, assignment editors. And so I had said to myself, I want to know, I'm nosy, you know, I'm curious about those women who decided to go behind the scenes and sort of stay on the management track. And so I said to myself, this is what I want my topic to be. My advisor, Darlene Clark Hine, who is actually the godmother of Black women's history, was the person who I worked with. And so it was just a natural topic. It was an outgrowth of my experience in the newsroom. It was an outgrowth of my observations in the newsroom. And, you know, going into teaching, I also felt as though it would just give me more information about the experiences, the lives, some of the challenges that Black women have faced. Also, no one had ever interviewed these women before. And so, you know, one of the goals of a dissertation is to create some new knowledge. And so my goal was to create some new knowledge about this group of women who, you know, really hadn't been on people's radar.
And so now you heard Ava kind of allude to the fact that I was behind the scenes, because most of you, probably almost everybody that listens to the show thinks that I've just been doing the show and I've been like kind of in front of camera or microphone or whatever. But for years when I knew Ava, when we both were working in the business, she was in front of the camera, but I was working as an associate producer and producer both in radio and television for a number of years before I kind of made some career shifts. But it's always been my passion to be involved in journalism. And so, and I did want to be in front of the camera, but it took me a while to kind of realize being behind the camera, not such a bad thing. You know, you get to kind of have a little bit more, I guess you could say, control in a way, you know, which my husband would say, yes, she's a control freak, but it's not just that. It's a matter of having some input and just get, and being able to observe the other people who are decision makers and how to internalize that and making sure that things are covered, especially when it comes to covering minority issues, you know, because, you know, as a minority woman, you have a unique perspective in terms of what might be happening in a
Absolutely.
Particular situation that no one else would think about.
Absolutely. So you're absolutely right about that, this issue of control, and this is why the title is Ladies Leading, the Black Women Who Control Television News. You know, I knew that as an on-camera reporter, the only thing I really had control over was my minute 30 story. You know, women mm-hmm. who are working behind the scenes are controlling multiple stories, and those who are managers are controlling not just stories, but they're controlling people's schedules. They're controlling how the newsroom markets itself. They're controlling the imaging of the anchors. They're controlling everything. And so one of the things that was really important to me with the title of the book was to say to the readers, this is a group of women having sometimes what we might call invisible power. And to me, invisible power is the most important type of power because it operates and you don't even necessarily know it's there. And mm-hmm. for the most part, white men have dominated this area over the course of, you know, since the beginning of television news, period. And so I wanted to show that these women have been there in small numbers, you know, starting in the late 70s, starting in, you know, into the early 80s. And so this cohort of women who began integrating the ranks of management is now coming to retirement age. You know, and of course there are new women who are filling those spaces, people like Kimberly Godwin, who, you know, just became president of ABC News, and Rashida Jones, who became a president of MSNBC News. So we are seeing some improvement, though slow. There is improvement, and there are women who are in those top, black women who are in those top echelons of TV news, and I wanted to highlight them. And so one of the things that I did in addition to the book was to also have a companion podcast. And the first few episodes, and you can just go to ladiesleading.net, that's the website for you to find the book and the podcast. But one of my goals with the podcast, I started with some of my students, journalism students, because I wanted to get their perspective on how they saw these women's experiences, how they were connected or not connected even to their experiences, you know, both as students as well as interns. And sadly, what I found is that many of them who had been in internships were already experiencing microaggressions, and that's a big theme in the book is microaggressions. And that really made me sad. And at the end, I said to the students, well, I hope I haven't turned you off, you know, to the news business. And, you know, they said, no, you just helped us be more prepared for what we might expect. So you know how it goes. You know, you take some steps forward, some steps backwards, some steps forward, some steps backward. But in the end, you want the trajectory, you know, to be forward in terms of what the graph looks like. So this idea of control, again, was so important to me that, you know, I had to make some decisions on how I wanted to publish the book. Did I want to go with an academic press? Did I want to go with a popular press? Did I want mm-hmm. to, in some way, sort of self-publish? So I decided to go with BK Royston, which is a black woman-owned kind of boutique publisher. But the thing I like about her is she doesn't control your content, tell you what to write, like some of those other, you know, entities, the academic presses and the popular presses. And that was important to me, you know, at this stage in my life, to have control over the product. And so that if I wanted to do something with the content, then I own that content. So, for example, about a month ago, Journalism, the website with Richard Prince, featured a chapter of the book on his website, the chapter that talked about how some women felt they needed to suppress hair, body, and all kinds of things in terms of their being in order to fit mm-hmm. in. And so he called me and he said, yeah, I just want to check and see if it would be, what do you think about this? Would it be okay? And I smiled, although he couldn't see the smile, maybe he could hear it over the phone. And I said, you know, you have my permission. And that made me feel so good because I didn't have to ask anybody else for permission to share my words, my content, my book. So that piece of control is really, it's empowering, and it feels like some kind of freedom that typically we aren't used to having.
No, we're not. I mean, even in, and I think back to even in positions of power or that you think are in power or you may have thought you were in power at one point in time, there was still always, you know, a man seeming like controlling, because I think about the newsroom that you and I shared, you know, in the business, and there were a lot of women in that newsroom. There were associate producers, there were producers, mm-hmm. there were women on camera who still had, you know, a certain amount of say, but when you came right down to it, the news director, the assignment editor, and some other people in key positions, the you know, manager of the station or whatever, they were all men.
All white men, let's be clear.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Except for one. What was his name? Morris Pyle, I think, was he had a role, a management role, I think toward the end there. I don't know if you worked with him or not. But, you know, one of the things this project did for me, Gretchen, was it conjured up some microaggressions that I had experienced in the newsroom that I had never really talked about. I remember one time I had gone out to cover something happened at, and I can't even remember where it was. You know how they say, I can't remember the details, but I remember how it made me feel. And one of the white male managers, and I don't even remember his name, to be honest with you, at this point, but I had come back from the newsroom, and I had gotten this interview that none of the other stations got. And he was shocked. He said to me, well, who did you sleep with to get that interview?
And
I thought to myself, I didn't sleep with anybody. I got it because I'm good. That's how I got the interview. That's what I was thinking, but I was so shocked that he would say something like that I just kept working and kept my head down. And I think that's how microaggressions operate, is sometimes you're so shocked that a person would utter those words that you're not sure what to say. But it stays with you, you know, time after time. And here we are probably nearly 30 years later, and I still remember that. And I remember this guy's face. I would have to go back to try to remember his name because he stayed there long as a manager. But, you know, it's those kinds of things that try to diminish black women's ability and their intellect along with their skills. And so, you know, when we think about the intersection of those identities, you know, I recognize in the book that obviously there are other women who are not black women who experience some of the same things that black women experience. But the truth is, when you deal with two historically marginalized identities, you know, both being a woman and being black, now in some ways that can be a double whammy. And so what I'm arguing in the book is, let's make sure we recognize that black women probably get it worse than other women, but that if we can fix some of this and disrupt some of this, then we make it better for all women and all people who may not fit the standard mold of being, you know, a white male. And again, this is not to white male bash. That's not what I'm doing. What I'm trying to do is highlight the sacrifices that black women have made, not only the microaggressions that they've experienced, but also the benefits, you know, the expertise that they bring to the news. And kind of like what you were saying earlier, you know, when we look at certain stories, we're going to look at them from the lens of being a woman and the lens of being a black woman. So one example in the book where I talk about is the fact that black women are much more conscious about how they use racial identifiers when it comes to stories about people involved in crime. Because the standard line that the police records give, you know, suspect was described as a black male. Well, that could be anybody, right? You know,
right.
A black woman has a father, might have sons, might have nephews, might have a husband who's a black male, and they don't want that description going out because that means it could impact people they love. And so one of the things that I've included in the book is how when black women become managers, often that's one of the first things they do is look at the racial identification policy of their station, and they typically will standardize it. They're going to say, if we're going to use race for crime suspects, we're going to use it across the board. So that means we're going to say, if it's a white male, we're going to say it's a white male. And, you know, that's something that can easily not be a part of standard practice and best practices in a newsroom if somebody's not, you know, keeping their eye on the prize as far as that goes.
You know what is the, for me, very sad and frustrating thing about what you've just been saying is that we were having the same discussion 40 years ago when we were part of the Black Journalist Group in Tampa. And we would have these discussions with some of the decision makers of the station we worked at. And, you know, we talked about coverage in terms of, you know, using descriptions and stuff. But not only that, I think one of the things we also talked about was, you know, the coverage. Why are you covering constantly, for example, the corner grocery store crime, you know, or the corner drug crime that may involve an African-American a little more often than others? Why aren't you covering the people who bring the drugs into the country, you know,
right.
You know, in some of the usage of drugs in the suburban neighborhoods and things of that nature, which in a lot of cases would not be African-Americans. That would be, you know, white people or people of you know, other backgrounds, you know. But it's a shame that,
again,
40 years
that,
we're still having that conversation.
Well, we are, and I think the reason we are is because, again, the numbers are still relatively small, and those who are don't have that experience of being black or being, you know, a person, they haven't been educated enough, right? And I think this is why it's so important for the next generation. I do see, for example, in my journalism students in classes, I think more consciousness among white students just in general. And I think part of that has had to do with the kinds of courses they've been exposed to. Part of that has been due to just the world that they live in now. You know, they're in a George Floyd and a Ahmaud Arbery and a Breonna Taylor world. And I think all of those things are having an impact. But having said that, you and I both know that the impact only goes so far depending on who your boss is and depending on what their expectations are and how they run a newsroom and how they put out there what's really important. And so to your point about, okay, why are we always covering the petty crime? Yes, you have to ask yourself, and these women in my study, there were 40 women who I interviewed for this book, you know, one of the other areas that they really were adamant about is two things. The so-called missing white woman syndrome, that's where network television news tends to, you know, go crazy with over-coverage, women who go missing, but often don't give the time of day to women of color, you know, who aren't in that category. So, you know, we've all heard of Natalie Holloway, right? We've all heard of Kaylee Anthony. You know, these are names that are just burned into the brains of Americans. Why? Because they've heard those names over and over. But if you think about other names, and I say in the book, Diamond and Tiana Bradley, you know, you get a blank stare, and those are two young black sisters who went missing more than a decade ago in the Chicago area and still haven't been found. And so black women are going to be more attuned to that and are going to provide more balance because they're saying, look, I'm a black woman and my life is valuable, and therefore I want to make sure that in my news coverage that I'm valuing black women the same way that I value white women. The other area is, you know, understanding the nuance of our communities. And again, that means not always covering, like you said, the petty crime, but digging deeper to understand what are the systems that create these scenarios where people, where crimes of opportunity are the only options that people think they have in terms of how they're going to make a living. And so that's a real different kind of story and a framing of the story that's, you know, really, really important. You know, you asked earlier about, you know, coming to this decision to focus on these women. So it's interesting that you say you always wanted to be in front of the camera. I actually, when I started out, wanted to be behind the camera and wanted to be in management. But unfortunately, every manager I met in the business, I felt it was semi-crazy. And I said to myself, well, if I have to be like that, I don't want to be a manager. I don't want to be behind the camera. And that's really one of the reasons why I stayed on the track in front of the camera because, you know, I felt like, okay, well, I can control my story. I don't know that I want to control all these other people who are sometimes prima donnas and sometimes the egos, you know, really get in the way of actually doing the news. You know, you get into the point where it's really, you're not managing the news product. You're managing This was my way to get a little bit of a taste of what it would have been like had I chosen to go the path of management.
And see, I think the path that I was on helped me prepare for what I'm doing with this podcast right now, in terms of, you know, how to, you know, how to contact people, who to engage with, and to look at how to create stories and stuff like that. The other thing that, though, but you're right in terms of the managing people, that's that's something else. And the other thing that used to drive me crazy was that when ratings came up and you had consultants, and you had to almost lose sight of your better judgment because they wanted to do the story that was going to get the most ratings, and what the consultants, these overpaid consultants, said that should be the story for the next month or so. So I never that was always a big battle for me. So
absolutely, the consultants coming in telling you, telling the anchors and reporters, wear this, wear that, do the story this way, do the story that, you know, and then they'd leave, right, and go on to the next station. And then we'd be left with, well, does this really work? You know, I think that would be an interesting study to go back to some of those themes that they really pushed to see which ones worked and which ones didn't. But that was, at the time, you know, part of, right, the management ethos. They needed to bring in some of these people. And, you know, when in essence, no one really fully knows, right, what a viewer is actually, what's going to resonate with a viewer and what's not. I think the nature of news is that it's different every day, and that's what makes it stressful for people, is that they have to really think, who is my audience, and, you know, what do I know about that audience in terms of how they might respond? But at the same time, it's also, what is the news? You know, it's subjective too, you know, in terms of the editorial content.
Well, I think some of it is conditioning. You know, it's like, if we keep giving you this, this is what you're going to expect, you know, and this
right.
is what
this
you're
is
going
what
to
you're
think.
Going to want eventually, right?
Right. And this is what you think that you're supposed to get from a news story, you know, versus, and then also too, you know, let's play who can beat the other person to get the story there. And you know, some of the facts get lost in the shuffle sometimes. And my thing has always been, you know, do you have to be like that other station? Yeah.
Oh,
can't
agreed.
You
don't you remember? Well, don't you remember how we used to hold, you know, you'd have the monitors up there, and, you know, the assignment editor would be watching all the competitor stations and saying, well, what did they lead with? What did they lead with? And, you know, in the end, it felt like we all were doing kind of the same stories. They might have been done slightly different because of who was covering that story. But for the most part, you know, pretty much the same story. And if you think about it, that shouldn't be, right? If we actually have different people in each newsroom and different people leading it, but that pack mentality, as you're alluding to, is real. And it shows
right.
up in the types of stories are covered and how they're covered.
Right. And I would even see where they would shift stories during the newscast to push it higher up, because they didn't want to feel, you know, wanted to appear that we had missed the story.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that we had missed the story, but we just thought that another story was more, you know,
important.
Credible.
Yeah.
You know,
yep.
And it's a matter of just sticking to your guns, you know, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but that's just life anyway.
Well, I think if we spent less of our brain power on that and more thinking about what stories are really important and what stories are going to make a difference, I think that's where we could actually win more. So there's this, I don't know if you're familiar with this term, solutions journalism, but it was the concept was sort of developed by, if we were online, I could put a link in the chat, but Tina Rosenberg started this thinking around. It's been around for a long time, And it's this idea that journalists, instead of covering only problems, need to think mm-hmm. about where are there places that have worked and mm-hmm. start to cover those stories in depth. So if you look on their website, it says, we train and connect journalists to cover what's missing in today's news and how people are responding to problems. We're working to bring solutions journalism to every newsroom worldwide. And that really resonates with me because I feel people are turned off by news because it's so negative. And that's not to say that you don't mm-hmm. cover those stories because, you know, what's happening with the Delta variant, what's happening not just in your city, in your state, but what's happening worldwide, that's important, and that should be covered. But also
right.
I want to know where are things working because it gives you some balance. Because otherwise, like in a city like Chicago, when you watch the news, you could be so depressed after you watch it that you wouldn't go out because you think that violence is, and shootings are occurring in every community, in every corner of the city, and that's just not true. So the perspective and context, I think, is often what's missing from particularly television news journalism. You know, we have a 19-20 minute news hole to fill, you know, around commercials. And so we have a very limited time every day. And if we're constantly feeding our viewers with a steady diet of crime, mayhem, and bad things are happening, I think it leads to us believing that the world is just a horrible place and there's nothing we can do about it.
Right, and that's not
so
true at all. We can always do something.
Correct.
I mean, you may not necessarily get it all right all the time, but every little bit helps for sure.
Absolutely. And so Solutions Journalism Network, for any of your listeners who want to know more about it, can just go to that website and get more details about it.
Okay. And I'm going to look it up and post it on the G's Power Hour Facebook page. In the meantime, we're actually going to take a break. We haven't done that yet, but we're going to do that. And then when we come back, I want to talk to you about the one of the things that was mentioned to one of the people you interviewed, and that is, why do we always have to cover black people?
Oh, yeah.
I want to get to that when we come back. We are here
okay.
with Dr. Ava Thompson-Greenwell. She is a professor at Northwestern University, and we are talking about her book, Ladies Leading. This is G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment, and we will be right back.
Over the past 60 years, Dove Beauty Bar's superior formula has remained unchanged. But when it comes to beauty, everything changed. Together, we redefined beauty. We said no to stereotypes and yes to every type. We let go of judgments and embraced what makes us unique. We're proud to have been there with you, caring for you every step of the way. Here's to the next 60 years.
Having a wedding, reception, family reunion, planning a banquet, or some other fundraising event. Need to share your knowledge through a workshop or seminar. Or it's a difficult time and you need to plan a wake or repast. Let us help. At our gatherings, let us reduce the stress and make the occasion memorable, treasured. Call our gatherings at 407-968-9387 or email ourgatherings@yahoo.com. Let us help plan your special event.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. We are talking about the book Ladies Leading with its author, Dr. Ava Thompson-Greenwell, professor at Northwestern University. If you have questions or comments, the number is 516-387-1944. And so, why do we always have to cover black people, Ava?
Well, that was one of the questions, right? One of the white male managers had asked one of the women featured in the book. And so, you know, they got all kinds of not only questions, but they were cursed at. They were, you know, people would go above their heads because they just were not used to working with black women. And so mm-hmm. that's the generation that
And I would say I hope that, you know, as time has gone on, these are some of the women who, you know, were entering or integrating those management ranks early, you know, in time in terms of, you know, when some of the ones first integrated newsrooms, which, as I was saying earlier, was late 70s, early 80s. You know, one would hope that they wouldn't hear that today in 2021. One would hope. But yet, you know, those microaggressions still exist, right, where the women, people are surprised that a black woman's in that position. So that's one of the things that they continue to have to navigate, maybe not as frequently as, say, back in the 80s and 90s and even early 2000s, but microaggressions, as we know, still exist. One of the things that I've done with the podcast is starting in, well, next month, I'm going to be pivoting to include not just journalism or journalists, but black women who are excelling in all fields. And I'm going to start with people I know, because I know a lot of black women who are really excelling. You know, that's not necessarily the exception. It's actually more of the rule, you know, when I think about it. You know, sometimes we are expected to be the exceptional Negroes, and that those are not, that those are few and far between. But there actually are lots of black women achievers in my world, and I'm sure in your world as well. So I think I'll need to have you on my podcast as well, because you're a lady leading also.
Well, I don't know about that. I'm just trying to survive, tell you the truth, Ava, in this crazy world we got. But you know, I would be honored. But I wanted to find out from you, when you were doing the book, which of the people that you interviewed really, I guess, stuck, you know, out for you, that stayed on your mind, and why?
There were a couple of women, and by the way, you know, I keep the women's true name anonymous, and I did that for a reason.
Okay.
And the reason is obvious. It's obvious, right, that the women, I didn't want them to get fired, right? I didn't want what they would say in the book to come back to haunt them later on. And I knew that had I named them, that they could have had some difficulties. And also, I wanted them to be honest, right? I wanted to hear directly from them and, you know, straight up no chaser, no sugarcoating of some of the stories that they had experienced. But I would say one woman, for example, she had moved 12 times for her career. I mean, you and I both know that there's a high turnover in TV news, and particularly in management. You know, you go in, and, you know, if the ratings aren't the way the general manager wants them to be, then you move on and you get a job some other place. So I was thinking about the impact that that had on her family, and she had children. She talked about how, on the one hand, having that kind of job gave her gave her the finances to be able to, you know, take her kids on vacation and, you know, do some special things for them that she wouldn't have been able to had she had a lower paying job. But then the damage, too, was that she was constantly moving. And so, you know, her children had to make new friends, go to new schools, all of that. I think the other thing that comes to mind was how women had to sometimes take it, so to speak. There was one story where a woman was working as a manager at a network news, and she had told this younger white male producer to move this story in terms of the rundown. You know, as you know, as a producer, we have a rundown, which is essentially a map of where the stories are going to go in the newscast, in what order, how long they're going to be. And she had told this one younger white male to move this story, and he said, "I'm not moving it." And so she went back, told him again, "I told you to move that story, you need to move it." And he's like, "I'm not moving this story. You don't know what the F you're doing." Now, this is a subordinate, right, talking to a boss this way. And you know we would get fired if we did that, right? And so you know, when you think about developing the ability to try and deal with those kinds of things, if somebody doesn't believe you can do the job strictly because of your race and your gender, that's a lot to carry. Top of mind, the sacrifices that these women had to make. And this is on top of, I mean, being in a news business is a stressful job, regardless of your gender or your race. And so you're in a stressful situation. Now, on top of that, you got to deal with these other kinds of microaggressions and, in some cases, macroaggressions, and still keep your sanity.
Definitely.
And so those were just some of the challenges, I think, that really, you know, stood out for me. The other one was, and again, it's interesting that I'm leaning more toward how the women were able to navigate their profession and their family. I remember one woman talked about traveling a lot for her job. She was, she got a chance to go out periodically and field produce big stories for the network. And she said she had gotten back home and her children, they wouldn't even speak to her because she had been gone so much. And so the job had, you know, consumed her so much that her children were, as she said, we all were just falling apart. And so, again, I think about those sacrifices, but I also think about some high points, you know, where the women were successful in teaching producers why you don't just say suspect is described as a black male, and being successful at covering some stories about black women who went missing. And those stories would not have been covered. I remember one woman said that they had gotten a report from the sheriff's department, and it was a young black girl who had been missing. And so the white male anchor said, I don't think we should do anything with that. She's probably just a runaway. Now, the black woman manager said that report had sat on the assignment desk for several nights, and finally she said, we're doing this story. And so giving value and dignity and respect to this young black girl who had gone missing, that's important. And so those are the kinds of differences that maybe the average viewer doesn't necessarily recognize. But I think that had those women not been in those positions, those stories would never have seen the light of day, or the change of making sure racial identifiers are used consistently, again, wouldn't be there. And I interviewed also some of the women's mentees and their mentors, you know, to get some perspective from an outside entity. And I remember one manager said to me, oh, I was in a meeting where so-and-so basically stood her ground and said, we are not going to use this term. Suspect is described as a black male. We're going to either provide more details because, you know, a black male could be from, you know, ivory colored to ebony cover, you know, colored in terms of skin tone, you know, all these differences that exist within the race. And he said, and I know for a fact that that discussion never would have happened had this black woman manager not raised the issue in that meeting. And so there were other, you know, anecdotes, and which I point to as evidence that these black women were making a big difference in the newsroom. The challenge is, of course, is to institutionalize these changes so that when these women leave or go on for other jobs, what they've laid the groundwork for doesn't get holes in it so that things fall through the crack. And I think that's the real challenge that I think we face today is how can we institutionalize some of these practices so that no matter what newsroom we go into, these things are considered best practices.
I kind of want to go back to, and there's so many things I can go back to, but I kind of want to go back to one of the things that you were saying about this industry, being in journalism, especially in broadcasting, and how, you know, you have to move around. And I think that was one of the things that made my final split with producer on a regular basis was I had gotten a job, very good job, in Ohio. And like she was saying, it's not like you have a choice. We have contracts usually, and I was like 2.5 years into my 3-year contract, and so it was time for me to decide where I was going next, you know, or if I was going to be able to stay or where I was going, you know, because in that business, you have to almost move in order to move up. It's like a step, you know, a series of steps. And I remember planning my mom's 70th birthday, surprise birthday party here in Florida from Ohio.
Mm.
And I'm an only child. And the thing about it is I think women really take this more seriously than men do, and I could be mistaken, but I'm thinking, yeah, I have family in Florida, but those are my parents. And it was time for me to make a critical decision, and I ended up coming back home, you know, no regrets. But, you know, it's interesting to me because you were talking about the woman that had to move several times, and it's like, you know, and you talked about the woman whose children wouldn't hardly speak to her because she was gone so long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we, I think, you know, unfortunately and disproportionately suffer when we make these career decisions, you know, and have to, you know, balance, you know, do you make the career decision or do you make the family decision? Why, you know, and this is where you can have it all or you can't have it all. Well, maybe you can have it all, but there may be a price. And you have to decide
what price
you're going to pay.
What I say is you can have it all, but just not at the same time. So
that's true
for me, that's one of the reasons that I left the industry is because my first child was born, you know, while I was still working on air in Tampa. And, you know, I really looked around and said, do I want somebody else raising my child or do I want to raise her? And the answer is I want to raise her. And I knew that working in news was going to put some real stressors on being able to do that. Now, having said that, you know, in 2005, I went back and did this fellowship in the newsroom in CBS Local, and I was there for a month. And I did find that the newsroom was a little kinder and gentler. I remember one day there having a meeting, and their reporters, because they had doctors,
you're kind of cutting out a little bit. Sorry.
Okay. Is that any better?
Yes.
Thing is, I remember going into the newsroom and seeing, it was a morning meeting, and typically, you know, reporters are in the morning meeting. And so in this particular meeting, there were no reporters. And so reporters had either doctor's appointments that morning or they had to take their kids someplace or whatever the reason was. And that was shocking to me because I know when we worked in the newsroom, it really felt like, well, if you need to go to the doctor, you just need to take off for that day, or you just need to take a sick day. And if you needed to leave early to get to your kids XYZ, you just didn't see that happen that much. And so it seemed like the newsroom had become a little more family friendly and kinder and gentler as far as that goes. And again, now that people are able to work from home remotely, which, you know, most people thought we would never be able to do that, but we see that it actually can be done. Maybe that's going to open up some more opportunities for people to feel and also experience a more family-friendly newsroom. But to your point, you know, I have never regretted leaving the news industry for my children, for my family, and it sounds like you don't regret having left for your mom and dad. And,
no,
you know,
not
I
at
think
all.
It's still a primary motivation. So on the one hand, we take these jobs because we, number one, can do the jobs and we're excellent at what we do. But we also take them because we want to stretch, you know, from generation to generation. And we want to be proud of ourselves and we want our family members to be proud of ourselves. But it's finding that balance of, you know, taking on the responsibilities of the job, but at the same time, not having to leave yourself, you know, take leave of yourself as it relates to your family. So I think that's probably still going to be a challenge, especially for women, for the foreseeable future. I don't know how to exactly get around that because it's so situational.
So Ava, you and the book were featured in the New York Times, and I know the National Association of Black Journalists.
That was so exciting.
Yeah. Tell me about that.
Oh, it was so exciting, but I almost thought it wasn't going to happen. So our Northwestern PR person had put out press releases on the book. And so Patrice Peck picked it up. And so she interviewed me at the end of March. I remember we were visiting my niece in North Carolina, and I was so excited for the call because, you know, I wanted not only the world to know about this, but, you know, there's some prestige, right, associated with being in the New York Times. And so she did the interview, and so I said, well, you know, let me know. She did some follow-up questions, some fact-checking. You know, weeks passed, months passed, and finally I thought, well, maybe they just decided they weren't going to do anything with it. And even the PR person at Northwestern said, you know, just don't be disappointed because sometimes, you know, they might reach out and then they might not do something, you know, might not actually follow through. And so finally one of the photo editors called me and said, oh, do you have a photo of yourself while you were still working at WFLA? I was like, I don't even think I have any photos of me working in news.
Wow.
Although when I went online, somebody found one really quickly, and I'm thinking, well, why didn't she just go online that way? But I was able to find my ID from WFLA. But in the end, it turned out she didn't even use it. So I'm not sure if she was just maybe doing some fact-checking, you know, a behind-the-scenes way of doing some fact-checking, or whether she was conceptually thinking about, because initially she asked if there were some women who'd be willing to be photographed. So I was able to find a few of the 40 women who said, okay, I'll be outed. I don't mind being photographed. But in the end, they decided to send a photographer, a local photographer here in the area, to photograph me. And so once they did that, I was thinking, okay, maybe it's going to happen. But there was still a few weeks after that before the story actually was published. So from late March to July 10th, that's how long it took to actually get the story published. But it still was good. You know, I was happy in the end with how it came out and just really thrilled to get the attention. And thrilled for the women to get the attention, more importantly.
Right, right. So tomorrow, a virtual National Association of Black Journalists convention, right?
Friday. We recorded, this is August, right, back in July, one of my former students who is Chanel Jones, who's, you know, one of the hosts for the third hour of the Today Show, she was the interviewer with me on the book. And so it would be J.A. there who attended the tune in to the discussion on the book.
Avery, you're picking up a little bit again. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah. No, that happens with my phone inside. Is that any better?
Yes, I have to move around
a little bit. Okay. So any NABJers out there, this Friday, 10:30 Eastern, we will be sharing that myself and Chanel Jones, and we'll have some live Q&A right after that. So that, too, is very exciting that the book was chosen as part of the NABJ Author Showcase. Virtual as it is, obviously I wish it were in person, but, you know, we still have to do those things that that keep everybody safe.
Right, because unfortunately one of the things that I think I saw that there were supposed to be some watch parties for part of the convention that had to be canceled because of some outbreaks. So.
You know, one of the other things that I wanted to share also with your audience is that, you know, during this time where I was finishing up the book, I was also directing and producing a documentary called Mandela in Chicago. And that documentary aired on the PBS station here in Chicago in February of this year, actually. And so the two main projects that I've been juggling are both the documentary and the book. And I have to say that, you know, as horrible as COVID has been, especially for the families who've lost loved ones and, you know, just the change of not being able to gather
with friends and family. It's been a very productive time for me. And so, you know, during those periods where it's the weekend and I can't go out, can't do anything, I would spend some of those days working on these two projects. And so in an ironic twist, you know, I've really been grateful for the time that allowed me to focus. And I think mm-hmm. I would have been much more distracted. And also it gave me something else to think about other than all the, you know, bad things that were happening in the world. So in an ironic twist, I would say COVID has been good for me in terms of being able to helping me have a forward trajectory. I also started a coaching business during this time period as well. I got a coaching certification in life coaching, and I'm coaching around microaggressions and just people who want to make transitions and people who feel stuck, either mm-hmm. personally or professionally, who want to have some forward trajectory.
See, that's what I'm talking about is, you know, people were like, you know, what am I going to do? You know, I'm stuck and everything like that. Sometimes you've gotten stuck in a rut, and you do have to challenge yourself to kind of get back to where you're being a little bit more creative and you're challenging yourself a little bit more. And you know, but it did provide an opportunity, especially in your case, where you could bring out some of your best talent, you know. So really
Absolutely.
Appreciate that.
And I tell you, one of the things that I have loved, especially now that I'm pivoting the podcast to other women, the time went so fast. In conversation, and I know that that's what I have to be. And, you know, we'll hit stages in our career. You know, we've been doing something for a while, be a little bored mm-hmm. with certain things, or we're feeling like, okay, I need a new challenge here, or I need to go back to my first love.
Yeah.
I think that's just a reminder to everybody mm-hmm. that it's going to pass anyway. Question is, what are you going to do with that time?
Exactly. So I have posted your Mandela in Chicago information on the G's Power Hour Facebook page, and also the Ladies Leading information and the Solutions Journalism Network that you were talking about. So all of that is on the G's Power Hour Facebook page.
Great. Wonderful.
And we only have a couple minutes left, real quick. What do you hope the impact of Ladies Leading would be?
So I'm hoping it really threefold. One is I want to affirm the women who agreed to talk to me because, you know, most of them I didn't know or I didn't know them well. So the fact that they trusted me with their story is an honor. But I also want to do right by them. So I want them to be affirmed. Second of all, I want the next generation of Black women who are moving into these positions to learn from these women and to take it to the next step, you know, take it to the next phase. Learn from these women, but put your own spin on what you think it means to be a manager and how you think you bring your best self to that position. And then thirdly, I'm really hoping that people outside of the industry as well as inside the industry, people who are not women and who are not Black, have a better understanding of what the challenges are, but what mm-hmm. the triumphs are as well for being in TV news.
Ava, please come back to Florida when we get rid of this COVID thing. I look forward to seeing you.
Well, you know, you might have to get rid of your governor first before you get rid of COVID, depending
ooh,
on how it's going,
the way he's doing things,
right?
I didn't say anything. Thank you, Ava. God bless. Give my
all
love
right.
to your family.
All right.
And thank
care.
You all for
you too.
You too. Thank you all for joining us. Tomorrow we have Marion Trainer to come on to talk about keeping fit when we're going back to school. This is G's Power Hour. I never had it so good entertainment. Be well, be safe, be blessed, and please remember all real power comes from God. Take care.
If I put a fade away. the highest praise. Come on, saints, yeah. Come on and give it on up. Yeah. Y'all ready? Give up and say a word. Up your mind.